know, for 7 years, you had an easy route. We'll repeal, we'll replace, and he's never going to sign it. But I'm signing it. So it's a little bit different. But I'm ready to act. For 7 years, you promised the American people that you would repeal Obamacare. People are hurting. Inaction is not an option. And frankly, I don't think we should leave town unless we have a health insurance plan, unless we can give our people great health care, because we're close. We're very close.
President Donald Trump, ever the optimist, speaking at a luncheon today with Republican senators. Yet while health care is among the top issues for Republican voters now, it is not the top priority. Terrorism and immigration are more important to Republican voters, according to a recent Harvard poll. Meanwhile, President Trump's approval ratings have dwindled to historic lows. He's now the least popular president at this stage of his presidency since modern polling began. But among his core supporters, Trump still gets high marks. Here to talk about what all this tells us about the Republican base and its priorities is John Feary. He's a Republican strategist and partner at the D.C. lobbying firm EFB Advocacy. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hey, great to be with you.
Okay, take us back, way back into the annals of the 2016 election. How big a priority was health care to voters?
Well, it was a very big priority for Republicans in Congress, not so much for President Trump. He was pushing other things like, as you said, immigration and terrorism. But remember that during the campaign, healthcare premiums in a lot of states were going through the roof, and a lot of Republicans were getting heat. And that is why this became one of the top priorities in the new Congress when Congress got formed at the beginning of this year. Republicans wanted to repeal and replace this. They especially wanted to repeal it. And this has been a longstanding promise for a lot of Republicans for 7 years, as President Trump pointed out.
Yeah, right. Well, let me cite the results of this poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation. It was released right after the election in November. And it found that just 5% of Republican voters cited health care as the biggest reason for their vote for President Trump. So what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that President Trump campaigned on something other than health care. And if truth be told, he wasn't really pushing this to be the number one thing that he wanted to get done. This is something that congressional leaders wanted to do first. And they wanted to do it not only because this is a promise that they've been having for 7 years, but it's also because of budget reasons. It made sense for them to pass it first because it helped make tax reform a lot easier, at least in the minds of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. The problem with that is this health care bill is very complicated, as President Trump discovered, and repealing and replacing it proved to be a lot more difficult than they thought.
Well, so 2020 hindsight and all, do you think it was a wise decision to tackle this first?
I always believed that it would make more sense to do things that are easier. I thought it was going to be, it made a lot more sense to do an infrastructure bill that would get Democratic votes and tax reform that would get Republican votes and have it in a big package and kind of govern in the middle and then do health care later when it became clear that the marketplace in health care was not sustainable. I always thought that doing health care first was going to be a big mistake because I thought it would take a lot longer than people anticipated and be a lot more complicated for Republican leaders to come up with a plan.
Well, surely Paul Ryan knew how complicated this was going to be. I mean, he's not new to this. So, and same with Mitch McConnell. So what was their calculation?
Well, I think what they initially anticipated doing was repealing Obamacare with a timetable and then replace it sometime in a couple years. And then if you recall, President Trump kind of screwed that up when he said, well, no, we got to do both in the same package. And also Republican rank-and-file members did not want to do a repeal first and replace later because they thought they would do something bad to the insurance markets. So this where it became complicated. The initial plan was to repeal first, replace later, and things just didn't work out that way.
Right. So he's still going to hold that vote, though. McConnell says next week he'll do that. What do you think he should be doing? Should he go ahead and hold that vote? I mean, he knows it's not going to pass.
Well, they're kind of half pregnant now. I mean, you know, the House Republicans have already passed a health care replacement bill, and Republicans now own this issue. So you might as well, if you can, get this thing passed. I think that Ultimately, if they don't pass it by the August recess, they should move on to something else. But as President Trump pointed out, they are very close. The problem for Republicans is that this is a very unpopular plan, and it's unpopular because no one really knows what's in it. They don't know the benefits. There have been no communications about the benefits. And the industry itself, the outside industry, the folks who, the hospitals, the doctors, the insurance companies, none of them like the bill, and many have been advertising against it. So this is another problem with this bill. It's unpopular, and people don't know what's in it.
Okay, so you have a senator like Dean Heller of Nevada. He's up for re-election next year. He's a more moderate senator. He has opposed this. And do you think that that is going to come back to haunt him, or will it be good for him as he seeks re-election?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult no matter what Senator Heller does. One of the complicating factors for him is that his governor has been really out front opposing the Obamacare replacement bill, and chiefly because of the Medicaid money that has been cut from this. So he's got to reconcile what's happening with his own governor, and he's got to find a strategy. But the problem for him is that if he alienates the Trump voters, you know, he's going to have a hard time in the primary and in the general election, because if Trump voters don't vote for him, he's not going to win re-election. So I think that for someone like Dean Heller, you know, he might want to go and sin bravely, hope that the vote for the bill and please the Trump voters, hope that the insurance market stabilizes, hope he can get the best possible deal on Medicaid funding that he can go back to his state and talk about, and then hopefully get Governor Sandoval on his side, because he doesn't want to have that kind of sniping at his back.
Well, can you explain the Trump voter, the mind of the Trump voter, because many of them do benefit from Obamacare, and yet you're saying that they oppose it.
Well, I think the Trump voter does benefit from Medicaid. A lot of them do. But what they really support is President Trump. And they want President Trump to succeed. And if you're going to oppose Senator Trump, President Trump, that is problematic for the average Trump voter. And they also want progress. They want the rest of the legislative agenda to be passed. Healthcare has really been slowing up everything else. They want President Trump to succeed. And so while many of them are on Medicaid or have Medicare or do benefit from Obamacare, they want the president to succeed. They want him to be successful.
What do you think would cause them to turn on him?
President Trump? You know, I think if the economy really takes a bad turn and if the president can't keep his promises. But, you know, I think that they're pretty solid with him right now. I mean, all the polls have shown that he still gets pretty high marks from his base, and that hasn't really changed that much. So, you know, he once said that he could shoot somebody in the streets of New York and still survive it. He said a lot of crazy things and done a lot of crazy things, and the Trump supporters are still supportive of him. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything that can shake the confidence of those voters in the president.
John Ferry, Republican strategist and partner at the lobbying firm EFB Advocacy. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right, let's hear from you now. Should Republicans keep trying to pass this Obamacare replacement or just give it up? You can weigh in on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. On the east side of the Colorado Street Bridge in Pasadena, there's a sign that says, "There is hope," along with a crisis hotline number. Suicide is not the answer, it says. Make the call. So far this year, police have gone to the bridge on 21 mental health calls. 6 of those were suicides. LA Times columnist Steve Lopez visited the bridge yesterday while work crews were putting up temporary barriers to stop jumpers. And he's here now. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. Well, this bridge, it does have a long history of suicide. I mean, it's known as the Suicide Bridge. Why is that?
Well, going back to this bridge was built sometime in the 30s. And during the Depression, that was when they had the most number, the highest number of jumpers. I mean, it was in the dozens. People experiencing, you know, financial ruin. Went to the bridge, and maybe that's what kind of sealed its reputation as the place to go if you wanted to end it all. There's something captivating about that bridge, as you know. Mm-hmm. The Beaux-Arts style, the grand arches, it spans this beautiful arroyo you've got, you know, downtown LA in one direction and the mountains rising up to the other side. And it's just it's a draw. It's a place that draws people who see beauty and people dealing with whatever darkness there is in their life. And they think that over the years, that's a place to end it all.
So over the years, have there been attempts to erect barriers that have not gone forward?
Yes, there have been, you know, there are barriers that did not exist. The city of Pasadena has prepared this report that's going to be in discussion this evening, actually, at a city council meeting when they try to figure out what measures to take to thwart potential jumpers. But, you see through photos going back through the decades, different attempts to put up this or that. And people have found a way to get around those barriers and to go over the top. Mm. And there are these pedestrian alcoves on the bridge, about 20 of them, and that's where most of the jumpers are taking off. And there are a number of reasons that the city is moving now. One is that this uptick really has them upset and concerned. Another is that there's a development right under the bridge. There's this Habitat for Humanity project, and the houses are nearing completion, and there's going to be a park there. So, you know, the danger posed by somebody coming over the side of that bridge, maybe hitting somebody in the park, or even just the trauma of being down there and witnessing that. I spoke to some of the employees there at Habitat for Humanity, the construction workers, and they said that some of them have been traumatized. They've seen police negotiating, trying to keep people from jumping. They've seen people jump. They've heard the thuds. And some of them seemed a little bit rattled by it.
Yeah, I can imagine. That would be quite traumatizing. So you were there with a woman named Keita Curry, and she runs the D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services. She admits to you, and you printed this in your column, that she has actually attempted suicide. What did she talk about, this rash of suicides at the Colorado Street Bridge?
Well, suicide is up nationally. There are about 44,000 in the country. California lags a little bit behind the rest of the country, but where there are increases, it's right now among middle-aged men. You know, then the numbers are a little bit smaller for elderly people and for young people. This is not a huge enough statistical blip that there's, you know, evidence of any particular cause. But she and the city are very much concerned about this copycat element here. You know, in the report, city officials ask, well, if we put up barriers, what's the point if somebody wants to take their own life? Aren't they going to find another way to do it? And Keita points out that, you know, you don't want this to be known as Suicide Bridge. You want it just to be known as a bridge. And she believes that it may be that if there's publicity about somebody jumping, somebody else who's sort of a little bit on the edge might think, well, why not? Maybe I'll do it too. So there is some concern among Keita and others that there's a copycat element going on here, which is another reason the city is moving quickly to do something.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's similar with the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, a similar kind of allure with that bridge, more famous bridge, of course, and also some, you know, wrangling and internal consternation over exactly what to do in terms of preventing suicides, but also maintaining access to this beautiful bridge.
Yeah, you know, an interesting point, since you bring up San Francisco. In the Pasadena City report, there is a mention of a study out of San Francisco where people who were talked out of jumping off the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, they followed up with them and found that the vast majority did not make another suicide attempt. Hmm. So it kind of suggests that there was kind of a copycat element to it, and the bridge did hold this allure, and that when somebody was convinced, hey, there may be hope, here's where you get some help, some counseling, those lives were saved.
Do you think those signs are going to help?
The signs?
On the bridge, yeah.
Well, no, the signs, I think, have been up there for a long time. I don't, you know, maybe it'll make somebody pause. I do think what's going to help is among the things they're considering. Right now, what they're doing is a temporary measure. They're blocking off access to those pedestrian alcoves. So it's going to be harder to get to where there's an easier takeoff point. But then what they're looking at as a more long-term solution, a fix, includes everything from extending the height of the fence all the way along the bridge and maybe having full-time staff out there. And then the other thing is some netting under the bridge to drape netting. And I think that's one of the more expensive fixes in the report. But that would certainly, you know, you can jump, but you're not going to kill yourself. So that's something else that will be under consideration.
Well, then I can imagine thrill seekers doing that.
Well,
you know,
you know, you may be right. And I don't know. So maybe they better go with a combination, right? Build the fence higher and put the nets there and maybe fines. I don't know.
Right. All right, Steve. Well, thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
That's Steve Lopez. He is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and we'd like to hear from you. Have you or other people you know struggled with depression, thoughts of suicide? How have you coped? You can reach out on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, how a small Mexican town took on drug traffickers, the resistance led by a grandma, and they won. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to Mexico now, where the people of one small town were tired of too much corruption and violence. And because they couldn't trust the police or other authorities to do anything about it, the residents decided to take matters into their own hands. The town is called Chiran. It's in the state of Michoacán, where authorities say almost 600 people were killed between January and May of this year. But in the town of Chiran, there hasn't been any serious crime, not one murder, since the residents began their resistance 6 years ago. It was started by a grandma, along with some other women. Patrick McDonald is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the LA Times, and he recently visited Chiran. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, what was going on in that town before they decided, the residents decided to take things into their own hands?
Chiran's a town of about 20,000, as you say, in Michoacán State, a very conflicted state. It's in a forested area, and one of the issues, a lot of times we think about drug trafficking in Mexico as being focused solely on drug trafficking. But the fact is these various cartels have expanded into a lot of other illicit enterprises, including extortion, kidnapping. In the case of Chiran, illegal logging. So for starting around 2008, there was very, very extensive illegal logging of the kind of the communal lands around town that people had relied on a long time. A lot of people have furniture workshops and so forth. So they were very brazen. People were armed, and they were just plundering the forest, you know, to the great dismay of the residents of Chiran, which I should mention is it's an indigenous community of mostly Purépecha Indians.
Okay. And so they saw this happening to their communal land, and they thought, this has got to stop. But here you have these cartels running a logging enterprise with massive trucks. What could they do?
I think they were stymied by that, you know, for some time. Some people stood up to them. There were a number of people murdered, disappeared, threats against people. And finally, one morning, it happened to be April 15, 2011, they basically, mostly women, decided they couldn't put it up with anymore, and they organized the town. They rang the church bells in the morning, and they stopped the first couple of logging trucks, took the loggers hostage, closed down the town for a period of a couple of days, and declared that these trucks would no longer enter. Eventually, a truce was worked out. The hostages were returned. But the town, rather than just stopping at that, kind of made the decision, which is somewhat fateful in Mexico, that it wasn't only a question of a criminal enterprise, but that the criminal enterprise was, in their view, kind of linked into the entire political process. So they kicked out the police force, the mayor, the city council, and they kind of set up their own self-government there, still within the Mexican state, but they have certain self-rule that they've managed to successfully implement for the last 6 years.
And you say this was organized by women, and in particular by this grandma named Josefina Estrada?
That's correct. Yes, she was one of the main organizers, you know, a petite grandma. Interesting. Chiron, I should also mention, is a town, like many towns in Michoacán, that has traditionally sent immigrants to the United States. Mm-hmm. She has 8 children. 6 of them live in the United States. North Carolina is a very prevalent kind of destination for people from Chiron. The town lives, to a large extent, off remittances from the United States. And many people, relatives in the States, were very alarmed by what was going on. Some people came back to help. But anyway, it was pretty much a spontaneous thing and somewhat successful.
What do you mean by somewhat? Because it sounds really successful when you consider there hasn't been any serious crime.
Definitely. From a law enforcement perspective, definitely successful. And security, you know, before I came to Mexico, I worked in the Middle East. Security is in conflict areas is probably people's preeminent concern. And the town is now secure. It's surrounded by insecure areas. But, I mean, it's not a paradise. The place is still very poor, still sends immigrants to the States. Mm-hmm. They're lagging in economic infrastructure and so forth, like a lot of towns. But they have security. And that, you know, really means a lot to people in places like Mexico, where lamentably there's a lot of conflict, not war-style conflict as in Syria or Iraq, but still quite a lot of conflict, disappearances, murders, extortions, and so forth. And people in Chiron just got fed up with that.
But why didn't the cartels fight back?
That's an interesting question. I mean, people in Chiron seem to think that they just had... It just wasn't worth the effort for them. I mean, there wasn't that much to exploit. The cartels are still working in neighboring areas. They're still doing illegal logging. They still, to a large extent, control the avocado market in a lot of those areas. And Michoacán's a major avocado-producing area. There's a lot of extortion against avocado producers. So the thinking seems to be that it really wasn't worth their time to kind of put up with this town that was in basic revolt against them. And the town, it wasn't armed at first, but they became armed. And they set up a self-defense force of about 120 people, you know, with automatic rifles. They have checkpoints. So they have a pretty sophisticated security system there now. So it's not, I mean, I think criminal enterprises, you know, like other businesses, probably want to go to the path of least resistance. There's a lot of other pickings in that area without bothering with a town that's completely armed at this point.
Right. And so, as you say, they kicked out the local police force and the local government. How did they do that? And now how do they run the town?
They were pretty smart about it because, as I mentioned earlier, it's a majority indigenous town. There's some, in Mexican law and in the Constitution and other laws, there's some provisions for self-government, some of which have been added in recent years, for towns that are majority indigenous. And they they found some very good lawyers who are knowledgeable in this, who've done this kind of work in Mexico and elsewhere in the world. And they basically fought a long legal battle, took 3 or 4 years, to kind of allow them to use this more traditional, localized form of government and not what, you know, is typical in Mexico, which is political parties, mayor, city council. They kind of set up their own town council based on local assemblies, using kind of what they call indigenous customs and the practices. And it was all declared legal at the end by the Supreme Court of Mexico. Now, the political parties aren't very happy about it. There's always a threat that it could be reversed. But the people, and I talked to a lot of people there, they seem quite happy about it because, as I said earlier, the residents, you know, security is a very crucial thing, you know, to people living in conflicted environments, you know, as I've seen here, the Middle East and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there any fear that the Mexican government will not allow them to continue to do that?
There's a lot of fear about that. There's a lot of fear about that. They're pretty well-armed intellectually and legally. They've already won a Supreme Court battle, and they have some very smart lawyers working on their behalf. And from what I understood, I think it would be rather difficult at this point for the state of Michoacán, which is controlled by a traditional political party, to kind of reverse what happened in Chiron. The Mexican government is concerned about this taking off in other towns, you know, the kicking out of political parties and so forth. But Chiron is somewhat sui generis. It's a very somewhat isolated place, but it's also very organized. It's one indigenous group, and they're pretty much on the same page. Some other towns have tried this. There were some divisions. It hasn't worked quite as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why haven't more Mexican towns done this? If it could be organized by a grandma, it seems that it could be done in other places.
Well, first of all, it has to be a majority indigenous town. You know, much of Mexico is mestizo or mixed race origin, so there's a relatively small number of just indigenous towns. And even in some of the indigenous towns, in Guerrero State, for instance, I know of one town that tried this, but there were 3 different indigenous groups, different languages, and it was hard for them to kind of agree on a system. In that sense, it's kind of hard to to see Chiran as a model for other towns, except very specific ones that fit into this category of indigenous and organized and kind of willing to put it together. They had some smart people in the town and outside helping them out. And it remains an experiment, but it seems, at least from a security standpoint, to have been a successful one.
Well, thank you very much. That's a great story.
My pleasure. Thank you, Madeline.
That's Patrick McDonald. He is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Coming up, playwright Lauren Yee on her new play, King of the Yees, set in San Francisco's Chinatown.
I'm excited by the ways in which, like, Chinatown and kind of Asian Americans on stage can be more than just, like, one very narrow story.
What it means to grow up in an Asian American community and then leave it and reject it. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 60-year-old Larry Yee is proud to be a Yee. In fact, his whole life is centered around preserving the Yee name. He's a character in a new play at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City called King of the Yees. It's a play within a play with a character named Lauren playing the real playwright, Lauren Yee. Lauren is Larry's daughter, and Lauren, the character, has changed her last name after marrying a Jewish man. And that's not the only example of how she has turned her back on her Chinese-American heritage. Her dad, Larry, is fiercely protective of the Yee name, though it becomes tainted when California State Senator Leland Yee is arrested on corruption charges involving a gangster named Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. That really happened. And it's a plot point in the play. Well, the real Lauren Yee joins me now to talk about her play, King of the Yees. Hello.
Hi there.
Okay, so the central dynamic in your play is Lauren's relationship with her father.
Yes.
And it takes place, as you write in the program, that we all receive as theater goers at the headquarters of the Yee Fung Toy. I'm quoting here, an obsolescent family association in San Francisco's Chinatown. So let me just play a clip. A scene from your play talking about that.
What about the story am I not getting right?
Chinatown is obsolescent?
Obsolescent?
Dead.
Dying.
We have all those people to thank, and Chinatown is dying?
Chinatown exists because 150 years ago, Chinese people couldn't live anywhere else. And today, some people consider Chinatown to be a museum piece, a filthy, broken ghetto that should just be erased.
Okay, so that's Lauren and her dad. You and your dad?
Played by actors,
yes. Played by actors. Okay, so you made the main character your name.
That's correct.
Because she is you, you are her.
I think I always thought my father deserved to have his own play because he is one of those larger-than-life characters that as soon as you meet him, the whole room becomes part of his story, that he brings people together. And as I was starting to write this play, which was a commission for the Goodman Theater in Chicago, I realized that the closer I got to who we are in real life, using our names, using the real circumstances, the more I could be specific in telling this very universal story about a father and a daughter in a very specific place, you know, San Francisco Chinatown, where I grew up. And so the play, in some ways, is very, very close to my father and our relationship. And kind of in being so close to reality, I'm able to add in kind of all the nuances of what makes Chinatown a wonderful, complicated place.
Okay, first let's talk about this association, the Yi Feng Toy, what you call an obsolescent family association. What is that?
Basically, you had all these Chinese male laborers who were here in America to build the railroad. And because of like anti-Chinese immigration laws, they couldn't bring their wives. They were all here by themselves. And so as a protective measure, they formed these clubs based on last names. And they used to be clubs for social activities to give these men a community because they didn't have family. But what's interesting is these clubs, the members in them, I've kind of went around and interviewed them. And almost all of them, when I asked them, why did you join? They said, my father or my uncle or my grandfather guilt tripped me into it. That they were like, if you don't join, we're going to close this club down and it's going to be all your fault. And so in a way, this organization has been dying for, you know, over 50 years. And it's that painful thing of what do you do when the things that your parents cherished and really nurtured are no longer useful to you. That story resonates for me as someone who grew up in San Francisco, where my parents and, you know, some of my grandparents were born. And, you know, now that I live in New York, where I don't have family, like, easily within reach.
Mm. Well, and here in Los Angeles, there's Chinatown near downtown, and it's so small, mm-hmm. just a couple of streets.
Yeah.
And it seems like it's mainly for tourists. And the real Chinatown, if you will, is mm-hmm. in the San Gabriel Valley, where many, many more Chinese immigrants mm-hmm. live and work and play and have their lives. And so I wonder how you think about your identity and your heritage, considering these ethnic enclaves, mm-hmm. many of which have become kind of just tourist areas.
Yeah, I think San Francisco's Chinatown is very similar to the Los Angeles Chinatown in that back when my father was a kid, it was very difficult for Chinese families to move outside of the borders of Chinatown simply because no one would sell you a house. And today, they have so much more choice. You get to live out anywhere. And so you don't need Chinatown.
But you lose something with that,
you
right?
You do lose something. And there is kind of that emotional pull at it that when I hear about kind of how San Francisco Chinatown is maybe being developed by much like bigger commercial enterprises instead of being the mom and pop stores that I grew up with, you know, it breaks my heart a little bit. But at the same time, I don't live in Chinatown. I understand why people would want the space and freedom to live elsewhere. It's the kind of that pull of like, what do you do with these institutions that may not serve you in the way they used to, but at the same time preserve that spirit? And I think that's what the play grapples with.
And how that is manifested in your relationship with your father mm-hmm. in the play, that he represents tradition, the old way of doing things, and you very much represent the new way of doing things. Mm-hmm. You're young, you've moved out, you've assimilated, if you will. Your character has outmarried, I guess, mm-hmm. is the word. Is that true in your case?
Oh, yes. My husband is not Chinese American. And I think it's that question of how do you preserve those experiences that you grew up with and pass them down to your children?
Do you speak Chinese?
I don't speak Chinese. My parents never sent me to Chinese school.
And they didn't speak it with you?
They speak it a little bit. I mean, they, you know, they were both born in San Francisco. And so for neither of my parents, it's like they weren't very good at speaking Chinese either. So like, why would their children be any better? But in retrospect, like all of my cousins and I are like, why did no one send us to Chinese school? And they're like, you didn't want to go. And I was like, I was 5 years old. How, you know, you can't ask a 5 year old what like the right call is.
Yeah. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Lauren Yee, the playwright. Her new play, King of the Yees, is up now at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. So a plot point, as I mentioned earlier, is the arrest of Leland Yee, the mm-hmm. state senator here in California, after he became involved with Raymond Shrimp Boy Chow. It's a crazy story. But in real life, how did that affect your father?
So my father, for the past, probably before Leland's arrest, like 15, 20 years, kind of as long as he's been involved in the Yifeng toy, has also been just like the super volunteer for Leland. And I think my father is fairly pragmatic about what happened. I can only imagine that he must have been quite shaken and surprised at like the depths of it.
I mean, did he take it personally because he shares the last name and because the idea of shame brought to the larger Yi name?
Definitely not a great day for Yi.
Or for Chow's.
Yeah, or definitely for Chow's. I guess it's hard to say because I think my father is a very kind of jovial and engaging person, but also I think, as you see in the play, like shies away from those kind of like heart-to-heart conversations where he's like, this is what's going on in my heart.
Mm-hmm. So at the outset of the play, there are two characters playing, and it's kind of a box within a box, playing you and the father. And then your father comes on stage and interrupts the action. But before that happens, the character who's playing Larry, before Larry the character comes on stage, is doing Larry in an entirely different way than the character who ends up playing Larry for most of the play does.
Yes.
So he has a sort of stereotypical Chinese-American accent. What were you trying to convey in terms of how Asian characters are portrayed in theater, on screen?
Yeah, I think I was interested in all the nuances of what like Chinese American and Asian American identity is in the 21st century. That I think there are so many nuances to those experiences because you have the experiences of Lauren and Larry in the play, but you also get the perspectives of some of the other characters who are played by this trio. You know, you hear the perspectives of these Asian American actors who are trying to like navigate the business of identity, that one of them is a Korean adoptee, that the other one is three quarters Chinese.
And that they're asked to play different, I guess, ethnicities, or they're asked to play, like a Korean is asked to play Chinese, is asked to play Japanese, what have you. There's a side scene between these two actors as they're waiting for the action to play out between you and your dad, where they discuss the roles that they have to take, because there frankly aren't that many roles for Asian American actors.
Yes.
And so one character who says she's Korean has to perfect her Chinese accent.
Yes. I think like particularly like Asian American actors are assumed to have knowledge of kind of like whatever segment of the Asian population they're being asked to portray. And so I find that like most Asian American actors just have terrible Asian accents, that they just like can't do it because why would they know? And so the kind of concessions that you have to make of like, do you like work on it really hard so that when you have to do it, you're like really accurate? Do you choose not to do it? Because people will kind of throw it in as something that's for comedy with like no bearing on like the actual story. I think all my plays tend to walk that line in between what is painful and what is funny, that I think those sort of things go hand in hand. Like the only reason why a scene about trying to learn how to do like a proper stereotypical Chinese accent is funny is because it's so painful.
So it's kind of ironic that the actress who plays you is Korean.
Yes.
Korean-American.
Yes.
Not Chinese-American.
I think this is a play that is absolutely definitely played by Asian-American actors. And I think like within that, I'm really interested in actors who kind of will gamely take on the task of portraying something they may not necessarily know intimately. Because even if you were Chinese American and playing this role, you probably don't know about the Yifeng toy. You're probably not from San Francisco. And I think the play is a lot about feeling like an inadequate vessel. And yet we still try to tell this story, that within the play, the character of Lauren feels like this inadequate vessel to carry on just the plethora of stories that her father has to tell. And the play is about her journey in claiming her background and her ability to tell those stories as limited and imperfect a storyteller as she is.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lauren Yee. She's the playwright of King of the Yees. It runs now through August 6th at the Kirk Douglas Theater in Culver City. Despacito is the number one streaming song more than 4 billion times. We'll find out why it's become such a hit next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Despacito, as of today, it is the most streamed song in history. 4.6 billion streams, to be exact. That includes both the original by Luis Fonsi, a Puerto Rican singer who has conquered charts in Latin America. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito, deja que te diga cosas al oído. And the remix with Justin Bieber. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito, deja que te diga cosas al oído. Well, the song reached number one on the Billboard charts in May, and it hasn't budged. And it's part of a trend of Latin music taking over the pop charts in the U.S. and globally. Here to tell us more is Carly Henriquez. She is music manager at the streaming service TuneIn. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us, our very own KCRW DJ Anthony Valadez.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks
Hi.
For having us.
So great to have you. Okay. So, Carly, let's talk about this song. The Latin version was released in January, right? And it quickly became number one on the Latin Billboard charts. Tell us about Luis Fonsi. Who is he?
Luis Fonsi has been on the block for a really long time, and this is an exciting time, not only for him and his camp, but for Latin music, you know, on its own. Luis has had a ton of just Latin hit when it comes to non-collaborations just on his own. He hangs out with the Marc Anthony's of the world, the Enrique Iglesias of the world. So it's time for him to shine, you know? So we got to remember, this is his song, not Yankees, not Bieber's, but Luis's.
And
so
the
I'm
video is him. It's not
It's him.
Biebs.
It's all about Luis.
Okay, but Biebs comes out with a version in April.
Oh, you are my sunrise on the darkest day, got me feeling some kind of way, make me want to savor every moment.
Then Daddy Yankee is featured on the song, and then Justin Bieber flies in and gives him, what do you call it, like a blessing to...
I call it cultural appropriation, but
yeah,
that's just me.
I mean, he pretty much blesses the guys.
Zang, zang, zang.
Like, here's a crossover blessing. I am Justin Bieber. You're welcome.
Kind of like what Elvis did in the 50s.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't around then. So
neither was
I,
but...
Me neither, believe it or not. So I guess you don't like that version.
I you know, it's not that I don't like it. I'm happy, you know, for all the artists involved. I think it's great. It's just... It's, I mean, I play devil's advocate with the situation. On one hand, I'm like, you know, there's a major Laser remix. It's this community coming in that was never a part of it and that are trying to jump on the bandwagon. But but on the other hand, I think it is a great thing. I think it is a blessing. I think that I hope folks who love Justin Bieber can jump on this and also maybe explore other Latin sounds. You know, we are part of the Latin Music Conference, the Latin Alternative Music Conference, which takes place in New York. And there's so much more than just this. But I think maybe this could be that stepping stone to help the non-Latino audience explore what else is out there in the Latin diaspora.
So, but what is it, Carly, about this song in particular? Why so popular?
Okay, so I think one of the main reasons the song is so popular is because we now stream everything. Mm. I don't think it's just the song itself. I think it's just the way we're listening to music. So now we're you know, exposed to more genres. We're exposed to global sounds, and we're wanting to embrace something outside of what we're used to. So I think that's why the song is so popular. Not only is it just one language, it's two. So that's also really exciting. And I think Latin artists have been have had a really tough time crossing over to the English market. And this was the perfect song to introduce everyone to what two different languages could really create behind the microphone and in the studio, which is a huge hit.
But what about Shakira? She's crossed over.
I think to ride on what Carly was talking about, you know, we're seeing this merge of cross genres coming together, you know, with hip hop and soul and rock and all these different elements. And even like when you study a song like Despacito, the reggaeton drum pattern, we're starting to see in pop music and electronic music. And I like that.
I mean, Shakira, she has her hips, and then she became a she-wolf, and then it just kind of went away. And I think it's a persistence. Daddy Yankee, let's please give him credit, because Daddy Yankee has been on the block for a very, very long time. He has been on, like, the general market stations. And I do want to give him a huge shout-out for that, because without Yankee on the track, Luis Fonsi would have been limited to the audience when it comes to the reggaeton scene that you just mentioned.
Absolutely.
And that different type of audience.
Okay, let's talk about another song by Lando. This is by Enrique Iglesias, and it features Sean Paul, a Jamaican rapper.
Got me feeling like I'm flying like I'm out in space. Something about your body says come.
Anthony.
He said, got me flying like I'm in outer space. That, I mean, come on, we're better than that, Latinos. We're better than that.
Does it sound better in Spanish?
Yeah, you know, that happens a lot, too, where, like, they have Latin writers in the studio, and they're just, like, kind of using a Google translator to translate it into English.
Work. But that, so that's also the Caribbean influence as well.
It is. It's that tropical 4x4 drum pattern. That I remember, do you remember, Carly, there was like a stigma, a negative thing to reggaeton when everybody was sick of reggaeton because the beat was like, oh, there's that beat again.
It was really sloppy.
It was really sloppy.
It was introduced, it wasn't introduced the right way. It was introduced as very urban music, Latin urban music. And it's not. It's influenced by so many different type of sounds in Latin America that the way that it was introduced is limited it from being bigger. Yeah. Without that influence, we wouldn't have Sean Paul till this day, you know, still performing and closing out venues on his own.
Yeah.
When Enrique came out with this song, it wasn't a surprise.
This
it
was in 2014.
Yeah,
by the
I mean,
way.
What was his other song? The romantic one, Can I Be Your Hero, Baby?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we got to talk about
like your
that.
Version,
that was,
actually.
That was a Latino on General Market. I remember Enrique then coming to Kiss FM here in Los Angeles and introducing that song to all of us. And we were like, that's a great song. But the second Sean Paul walked in, it was like, oh my God, that's a massive hit, you know, because he then gave us that extra flavor it needed. So Hispanics have been around the block, obviously. They have been on the radar, but it's now with Despacito that people are now, everyone's trying to get a song with some sort of Hispanic artist on there, which is great for us, you know?
Yeah.
Great for us.
Okay, let me play one more song. This song is called Wild Thoughts with Rihanna and DJ Khaled.
Wow, wow, wow. When I'm with you, all I get is wild thoughts.
Hey. This, Anthony, what do you think? You talked about cultural appropriation earlier. Mm-hmm. Is this an example of that, or is it an example of blending cultures to make a better song?
I would say blending cultures, because if you think about it, where is DJ Khaled from? He's from
Middle Eastern
descent. And then you have Rihanna from the Caribbean. And then you have Carlos Santana. Like, you've got these three elements coming together. And I think it's great. And I love that they sampled Carlos Santana. So it's almost like paying homage to the man who's making it possible, you know?
I don't think they should touch a classic like that.
I agree, but they did.
You don't touch Santana. You know what I
True.
Mean? Like, if anything, we should be thanking Santana. And kids that are listening right now, please Google Santana and Google this song and listen to the original. You will be
But how many times has James Brown been sampled?
Yeah. A million times. And I think this is why music streaming is so special, because, you know, we're now able to educate ourselves on, like, the originals versus what's been produced and sampled a million times. And this song, Wild Thoughts, is a big example of, like, huge hit makers, like, having the tools and resources to create something magical, but yet you're just going to pay $1 million for the sample and call it a day and create another hit.
Hey, Madeline, do you know what thought means? I'm curious.
Thought?
Yeah.
As in something that goes through your head?
It's Thoughts, though.
Thoughts.
U-G-H-T-S.
Do you want to tell her what it is?
What is it?
I think it's so awesome that you said it on it. That hottie over there.
That hoe over there.
Oh, I was just saying hot.
I see we have a different interpretation. Interesting.
Yeah.
Great. Sorry, Mom.
Carly Henriquez, music manager at the streaming service TuneIn, and Anthony Valadez, our very own KCRW DJ. Thank you.
Thank you. Hey.
Hala tu cuerpo pa' alegría, Macarena, que tu cuerpo es pa' dar la alegría y cosa buena. Hala tu cuerpo pa' alegría, Macarena, Macarena. Hala tu cuerpo pa' alegría, Macarena, que tu cuerpo pa' dar la alegría.
Okay, thank you, Sarah Sweeney, our director, surprising you with that lovely hit. Reminder
song
of
whose name shall not be mentioned.
Viral hits of yore. You can still hear that regularly at the Moonlight Rollerway, by the way, in case you need to hear that.
I don't. We can lose it.
Hi, Christian Bordal.
Thanks, guys. Well, I asked our listeners their thoughts on the song Despacito that you were just talking about, more specifically, since it's been streamed more than 4.6 billion times and counting more than any other song in history, is it the greatest song ever? And Anthony Williams wrote back, y'all are officially trolling with this press play. And Rich said, quantity doesn't equal quality, not even close. Despacito, better than Thriller? Psh, yeah, right. And then Renee says, no, I'm tired of listening to Despacito wherever I go. I hate the song. But Nick Tator says, don't be mean. Just because they won't stop playing it doesn't mean it's bad. And Nick Solish was the guy that was being mean. He said that auto-tune plus Justin Bieber equals cancer.
Oh.
Bit harsh.
Yeah.
I also ran a little Twitter poll.
Fake news.
That's right. And I ran a little Twitter poll asking people, you know, what they think of Despacito. Let's see. The latest poll numbers are 18% say it's pretty great, 61% say it's pretty awful, and 21% say, eh, big shrug. So there you have it. That's what our listeners think of the
song.
What
do you think?
Despacito.
You are a musician. Do you like it?
I don't know. I think the whole thing about sort of judging music, it's such a subjective thing anyway. So personally, it's not my favorite thing, but, you know, I'm certainly not going to tell someone else that it's a bad song if they like it.
Okay. I know what your favorite is. This song, because it means it's the end of your segment. Okay. Thank you, Christian Bordal. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.